Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. Steve Williamson here, and sitting across from me, Gary LeMaster.
Sitting in for Mike Cosentino, at least temporarily. He's on his way.
Yeah, he's on his way to do the show, and we have a mic ready for him. It has a nice little pink fuzzy thing on top of it. today we have, we're really pleased to have, you want to introduce him, Gary? You want to introduce Roger?
Yes, it's Roger Clark, who is, I don't remember the title.
He's program director.
With the Grand Canyon Trust. And you can find the information on the organization at grandcanyontrust.org. He has, he's a very articulate spokesperson for the organization and for the health of the Grand Canyon. And there's a number of issues that he has outlined involving the Grand Canyon. I will let him talk about those, but welcome to the show.
Thanks, Gary. It's a pleasure to be here. So again, I'm Roger Clark. I'm the Grand Canyon Program Director for the Grand Canyon Trust. We're a nonprofit organization that was founded in 1985. Opened an office in Flagstaff in 1988, and we've been around ever since. It's a regional group that is dedicated to protecting the Grand Canyon, but the surrounding Colorado Plateau.
And so the surrounding area.
Yeah, so we have work up into Utah and into some into Colorado and New Mexico, but mainly Arizona, northern Arizona and Utah.
It's a great organization. We had, I guess the fellow that you replaced on the show a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Very articulate, very good. Mm-hmm. The Grand Canyon, it was hard for it to become a national park. There was a
Correct.
Huge fight for, mm-hmm. for decades with the special interest to keep it from coming apart. It's under threat now.
Mm-hmm.
This is, I guess, is it the second most attended park in the country, national park in the country, and it's hugely popular.
Yeah,
and yet it's endangered. And what's it's endangered by? What are the principal things, Roger?
Well, the fundamental threat to the Grand Canyon is what it's always been. It's people seeing a way to make profit off of a spectacular landscape at the expense of the qualities for which it makes it unique and why it was created as a national park. So, for example, you mentioned in the early days before Grand Canyon was a park, it was developed in the early 1900s by independent entrepreneurs and the Fred Harvey and Santa Fe Railroad companies. They had lodges, hotels, all in the early 1900s. When Yellowstone was designated as a park by Congress back in the 1870s, even back then, Grand Canyon didn't have the political support to become a national park. There's been different set-asides through the years up until its designation as a park in 1919. But then, as now, commercial development, mining, and other kinds of entrees into the park are the fundamental threats. We still have mining, for example.
I think that may be news to some of our listeners mm-hmm. that even though it's a national park, the mm-hmm. most sort of protected places mm-hmm. that we have, there's still mining. And uranium mining, as we all know, has its danger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's uranium mining not only in the park, but mm-hmm. in the area surrounding it. And there are folks who want to have more uranium mines.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, the boundaries of the park, as established in 1919, encompassed only a portion of what people think of the Grand Canyon. So the upper reaches, the Marble Canyon, was not part of the Grand Canyon. And all the tributaries that come in from the north and south and from the east bring water into the Grand Canyon. And if that water is polluted, that's a problem for the Grand Canyon. Similarly, the Navajo Generating Station, largest coal-fired power plant in the west, sits to the north of Grand Canyon, and yet its pollution coming out of the stacks find their way into the Grand Canyon. So most of these threats are what you would call external threats. Grand Canyon is a national park, and it is perceived as being protected by the general public, and that's one of our greatest challenges. Even though we've got lines on the map and we have clear guidelines within those lines, the public lands, the Forest Service lands, and BLM lands are still open to mining around the park, and that's where uranium mining comes in. They're close enough to the park, and in some cases, the water that they use for the mines comes out of the same aquifers that feed the springs in the Grand Canyon. They're that close.
So one way to put it would be that the Grand Canyon Park is really not big enough to protect the entire ecological system, the Grand Canyon itself. Mm-hmm. So what can be done about this? And the lands around it, the mm-hmm. Forest Service lands and BLM lands around it, don't have the level of protection in the park. Mm-hmm. And so you can put in a new uranium mine within a few miles of the Grand Canyon.
Correct. As you look around the park and who the neighbors are, the largest neighbor is the Navajo Nation. And that's off to the east of Grand Canyon National Park. And when it comes to uranium mining, the Navajos experienced the brunt of the first wave of uranium mining and milling, and they're still bearing the brunt of the pollution of the groundwater, of surface contamination, and they banned all uranium mining in 2005 as a sovereign nation. They had that authority and just said no more. That's it.
Now you don't blame them after what happened to them.
Yeah, the Havasupai they've had mining in their lands, but their original lands included Grand Canyon Village and Tusien and Red Butte. That was all their Aboriginal lands. And where the canyon mine is, which is near Tusien and Red Butte in their traditional sacred area of Red Butte, is this new uranium mine. And it threatens to contaminate the water, the groundwater, that is the sole source of drinking water for the village of Supai. So they've kind of got two objections, the risk to their drinking water, but their bread and butter in terms of economy is tourism. And if the beautiful Havasu Falls that everyone loves to photograph and so on became contaminated and unsafe, that would be another huge hit to them. But they've consistently objected to uranium mining in their groundwater basin and their surface watershed. All this water that flows off the surface as well tends to wind up right by Supai Village on that side of the canyon. So you've got tribal interests, but then you mentioned the public lands. You've got Forest Service land on the north and south of the Grand Canyon, administered by the U.S. Forest Service and Department of Agriculture. On the north side, you have Bureau of Land Management lands, where many of these mines are located. And those are lands that are free and open for anyone to come in and file a claim under the 1872 mining law. And if they find valuable ore, it's basically private property. They get to mine it.
Right. They get to mine it, and they get to also not pay the public for our land. They get to basically confiscate our public land, make money off it, and not give us any money back.
Well, they pay 1872 prices. If there's some royalty involved, then that's what it is.
They get a quarter every quarter.
In case you hadn't noticed, Mike just joined us. Welcome to the show.
Both my fans out there are cheering right now.
Yeah. I think people would be shocked by the number of potential mines and mining claims. Roger told me before the show that if I understood him correctly, there were 10,000 new uranium claims on the land surrounding the Grand Canyon, which it was stunning.
Who is this, Ron? Who's the they in the uranium mining?
Well, it's a combination of the main company that is actively mining and milling uranium around the Grand Canyon. It's called Energy Fuels. And they have offices in Denver. They're connected to a Canadian umbrella corporation. And it's kind of the same characters that were the managers of a group called Denison. Mm-hmm. But they sold out to another group. They tend to do this. But back to the 10,000 claims.
It's like one of those Russian dolls with dolls within dolls within dolls.
Well,
to who actually owns what. Right?
Yeah, and this gets to, after they're finished profiting, how do you hold them accountable when they go bankrupt or change? And it's a very, even though there are bonds put down for mining on public land, it's insufficient.
The bonds are small compared to the amount of damage of actually cleaning it up. So who ends up paying to clean it up?
Well, in recent history, the mining industry and energy fuels and its predecessor have cleaned up several mines, like 8 mines on the north side, according to law. And by that, they've removed all the hardware, taken away the machinery, taken down the barbed wire fence, protecting it, leveled the land or contoured it back to pre-mine conditions, and have scattered some native grasses and plants, and pretty much that's it. They'd call it good.
Can the water still get down into the old mines and leak into the aquifer and go through the uranium pile?
It's what you don't see, that the unseen contamination deep below the surface. What happens when you open up uranium ore in the rock, the bedrock, the matrix of the rock? Once it's opened up for mining, it interacts with the air, it oxidizes, and uranium oxide is highly soluble in water. And they try and keep the mine shaft and obviously the working environment as dry as possible, but they introduce water into the shaft to cool the drill bits. And when they go down through the rock layers, they go through the Coconino sandstone, mm-hmm. which is another aquifer, mm-hmm. And it sometimes allows water to get into the shaft. And once the water comes into contact with the ore and dissolves and the uranium oxide becomes mobile, that's where the long-term concern occurs.
Roger, why don't you describe what a uranium mine looks like?
It's not
like an old coal mine. It's not a big lateral extension of tunnels, right?
Sure. There's many different ways to extract uranium. So around the Grand Canyon, it's a deep shaft. It's a vertical shaft that goes down parallel to where the ore body is. So it'll go down maybe 1,200 feet. I think the ore may start in around 800 feet below the surface, depending on the configuration of the deposits. It's found in the supine hermit formations of the Grand Canyon, if you're familiar with those layers. In fact, those are the same layers around Sedona.
Yeah.
But as it turns out, the deposits around here aren't highly mineralized like they are up around the Grand Canyon.
Darn.
Yeah, you could have real estate developers and uranium miners to fight off down here.
We're sure there's uranium next door to our where we go hiking.
So my question is, if I'm going to go hiking in the Grand Canyon, should I take a Geiger counter with me?
No. There are places that are known to be radioactive. One of those is the old copper mine down on Grandview Trail that happens to be in the same kind of geological formation where you find the uranium. Park Service, I think they've closed it off now to go back into the shaft. The other place to watch out for is Horn Creek, which is below a uranium mine called the Orphan Mine, which sits on the South Rim. It's being cleaned up by the federal taxpayer right now. Most recently, $15 million were spent just to get rid of the head rig and the hardware on the top, which was left behind. And it's now contaminated a creek that is formed by a spring way down about halfway into the canyon on the Tonto platform. So mm-hmm. if you're hiking on the Tonto Trail and you want to refill your canteen in Horn Creek, don't do it.
Okay. Well, I need to have one of those little patches on my shirt to see how much exposure I've got.
Sure.
The conflict is clear. The Grand Canyon is a big deal. The Grand Canyon is a BFD here, mm-hmm. But then so is uranium.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of this activity, besides profit, has to, I would imagine, has the encouragement or at least the approval of government.
Well, it does. The managing agencies of the Forest Service BLM lands have really their marching order. They have to allow mineral development under the 1872 mining law. And so their job is to minimize the impact or mitigate the impact, which is a nice way of saying they try and keep the pollution within certain thresholds. But there's no mistake about it. Even under permits and regulation, pollution is occurring. The question is, what are the long-term impacts? Who's affected? And how long is it going to take before we know those effects? With uranium and radioactive materials, sometimes the effects are a lifetime away.
Well, you can see all these things that Roger's explaining in Jerome. You can see head rigs up there and, and all sorts of mining apparatus that they use that they leave. They've left for tourist reasons, mostly, although there is some still some company activity, I know. But all this, if you don't want to go to the Grand, well, hopefully all this will be removed from there. But, you know, and it's both, you know, mining is a, as I said, is in Arizona is, you know, one of the state seal things. And so that becomes makes it sacred, but so is the Grand Canyon. So, and to everyone, even those in government.
Well, I think it's not the current government that's encouraging this. It's the fact that this 1870 law has never been reformed.
Oh, but they could change the law. They could update the law.
They've tried.
But I mean, you need a reasonable Congress.
You would need a Congress that wasn't bought and sold by the corporations.
Yeah, there's an alternative path, and we've tried it recently. It hasn't panned out yet, but we're not over. You can actually get the agencies to change the regulations without changing the law. So that they require groundwater monitoring, that they require tighter controls on what happens below the surface, which they aren't doing now. They kick that responsibility to the state of Arizona. So any activity below the surface is state jurisdiction. It's on the top. It's federal. And there's a kabuki dance that these agencies do around each other that ultimately means the mines are not properly regulated, and we can change and tighten those regulations. We petitioned, Grand Canyon Trust petitioned the Secretary of Interior, Secretary of Agriculture, to strategically change key elements of the federal regulations that implement the 1872 mining law. One of the key requests was that require groundwater monitoring around the mines. A real simple thing that should be done. It's done with copper mines in southern Arizona, but it's not done with uranium mines. And that could be done either as a general rule across the agency, or it could be done by the district or by the forest supervisor and the area manager for the BLM. They could say, we're going to require this because we believe it's best management practices and it's a smart thing to do. In fact, it is, but they're not doing it.
Why aren't they doing it? You put in the proposal, and what was the response?
Response was about a page and a half letter back from the Forest Service saying, we already do what you're asking. And that's true to some extent on new mines, but we're talking about four mines that were opened and approved in the 1980s, closed in the 1990s, and have reopened again here in the 2000s. And the agency's point is, we already gave approval. We don't need to redo the permits. We don't need to do anything. And so those rules that were established and adopted back in 1986 in the case of Canyon Mine are antiquated. We know a lot more about groundwater contamination than we did in 1986. And nevertheless, the Forest Service is not requiring something like groundwater monitoring.
I've lived in Arizona all my adult life, 45 years, and I've met copper miners, and I've met coal miners from other states. I've met malignant miners from Baghdad, but and my point here is I've never met a uranium miner. Is it a big employer?
The mine that's operating right now, Canyon Mine, I think has two shifts operating, and they're not even down to the ore yet. They're just sinking the shaft. And I think they're 12 to 15 person shifts with supervision, and so in Arizona about 30-35 people.
Okay. Mines open and close, folks, if you don't know what the price of uranium. So the price of uranium, so when Roger's talking about it, when uranium prices are high, the mines are going. When the uranium prices drop, they close them down, and then when the uranium prices rise again, they open them up. And that's the danger of having not only the old mines, but having lots of new mines in the area. I read a long article attacking a proposal to have a national monument. We should talk about that in a minute, Roger. Up in around the Grand Canyon to protect the water, the challenge to it is being led by the sheriff of Mohave County. Well, right. The sheriff is leaving the attack against the national monument is anybody's business. Mm-hmm. I mean, wow. But anyway, there was a long article in a newspaper called The Miner. Mm-hmm. And it went on and on and on about, well, they're going to interfere with hunting and they're going to keep recreational vehicles out and I don't know, the deer will run away and the elk will hide. And then at the bottom of the article, it said, uranium mining can produce a lot of jobs and money for Mohave County. So in the end, it was about preserving uranium mining in the monument.
I think in principle, Mohave County has historically been a mining district and they're very supportive of it. The reality is the current mine has no employees living in Mohave County. When these hard rock mines operate, they pay no royalties to the federal government. They pay very little in taxes, just retail taxes for equipment, things like that. So the net input to the local economy is very small compared to, say, tourism, which is the backbone of our industry here in northern Arizona. And if a popular spring gets contaminated, that's a huge potential hit to the recreation industry. That's why the recreation industry is opposed to the uranium mining. So the monument proposal for the Grand Canyon is about 1.7 million acres. To give you an idea, the Grand Canyon itself, within Grand Canyon National Park, is about 1.2 million. So it's actually would bring in more land, not into the park, but into a new category of management called a national monument. Now, national monuments have grazing in them. They have hunting in them. They have off-road vehicle use in them. They are not the most protective or the most restrictive of any of the federal designations.
Yeah, say that about 10 more times. Every corner in the Verde Valley, please.
Yeah, it's the other side has grabbed onto this fear tactic, which seems to be running rampant nowadays, and making up lies about what a monument does and doesn't do. We do know the one thing it affirmatively does, and I should say the national monument can be designated by the president under the 1906 Antiquities Act. Teddy Roosevelt was the first to use it, and he loved it because it gave the president the authority to, with the stroke of a pen, create and designate public lands as something special. The first monuments under the Antiquities Act were Mesa Verde. Mesa Verde was being looted and pot hunted and exploited, and citizens rose up and said, we need a law to help protect artifacts. Down here in the Verde Valley, you've got Montezuma Castle, you've got Tuzigut, you've got other places that aren't monuments but are protected now by the Forest Service up Boynton Canyon.
So originally the monument being proposed, mm-hmm. and was to protect the watershed from uranium mining, and it was called, and the name is now changed. The proposal's name is changed. So if you do a search on the internet, folks, you'll get, mm-hmm. different names for it.
Yeah, let me explain that between 2010 and 2012, there was a big evaluation of whether or not to protect the Grand Canyon from uranium mining. It was called the Northern Arizona Mineral Withdrawal. And what drove that was legislation that was introduced by Congressman Grijalva and supported by Congresswoman Kirkpatrick and others to create a Grand Canyon watershed national monument under congressional authority. When Grijalva and the Democrats lost in 2010 the House, the strategy shifted to protect the area under the authority of the administration for 20 years, and we got that in 2012. So the Grand Canyon, the areas under concern, none of the new claims can go forward for 20 years after signature in 2012. So we're under that right now. The old mines that were grandfathered in aren't affected. The next move was to make that 20-year ban permanent through designation as a monument under the president's authority. So Congress can do it, but the president can do it under the Antiquities Act. So between 2012 and now, 2016, the lead organizations were the Sierra Club and other national groups to get the Grand Canyon, Greater Grand Canyon Watershed National Monument designated. And that would make the 20-year ban on uranium mining permanent. It potentially could do some other things, but that was where we were. So, to make a long story short, in October 12th of this year, Congressman Grijalva teamed up with the tribes, Hopi, Navajo, Havasupai, and said, "We want to support this, but we're gonna make it emphasize the heritage, the cultural heritage. Grand Canyon, first and foremost, is a cultural landscape that most people don't see, because you don't see the religious shrines, the pilgrimages, the ceremonies that go on to this day, but it's all part of the cultural heritage of the American Southwest. And that heritage is one reason back in 1906 when they enacted the Antiquities Act, we wanted to protect the material artifacts, the ruins, but now the living people who are connected to those ruins are saying this is important. So Congressman Grijalva and the tribes took the watershed monument proposal and said one of the problems is the terms of the monument have not been clearly spelled out, particularly what it doesn't do. It doesn't remove hunting. It doesn't affect existing and historical uses. It doesn't affect current rules and management of off-road vehicles. All of that is not on the table with this monument designation. What it does do is create a new management guidance under purposes to protect the heritage, the cultural artifacts, but it also would, again, stop all new uranium mines, and as a result, the Grijalva proposal with the tribes was renamed to Greater Grand Canyon Heritage National Monument. So that's where we are in terms of the naming of it.
It's a good name. When you go to the Grand Canyon and you go to the IMAX movie,
right?
And you since you know we're all too old and lazy to walk anywhere. No, seriously, but you should go to see the IMAX movie. What I like about it is the opening scene.
Right.
It's a Native American walking mm-hmm. across the ridge, one of the ridges of the canyon. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if there is a theme that runs through the movie, other than the natural beauty of the canyon,
yeah.
It would be the Native American heritage concept. And, of course, the coming of mm-hmm. of the tourists,
sure,
as we've all been in the last 150 years.
There are ruins in the whole Grand Canyon area.
There are
ruins all the way up into Utah.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them, if you've been out, and I've been in the Archaeology Society for a long time, a lot of them are seeing damage, particularly mm-hmm. Almost deliberate damage by people in Utah, driving their ATVs mm-hmm. up things. And when I was at the Grand Gulch, one of the guys had come down and almost nowhere was there not signs of ATVs in mm-hmm. the Grand Gulch area.
Mm-hmm.
So there's another proposal for a national monument up there. What positive will the monument do? It'll definitely stop any new uranium mine.
That's the main thing.
And it'll protect the watershed from any mm-hmm. other kind of mining, right?
It's not specific to uranium mining, but that's really the only pressure on it. There's still copper deposits in there. The other thing it would do is set up the agencies would have to do a new management plan, and that initiates a whole new public process. The monument the language of the proclamation defines a purpose. And the purpose in this case would be to protect both the cultural and the biological, ecological aspects of that area, which is already being somewhat managed and protected under existing rules, but it would emphasize those as a priority, as a purpose in the new management plan. And then secondly, it would create an advisory group that would include some 21 tribal members from the affiliated tribes surrounding the Grand Canyon. And that's what people generally aren't aware of. They, not only are these archaeological sites connected to living cultures, there's an active practice, cultural practice that goes on these public lands around Red Butte and around the confluence of the Colorado and Little Colorado River that continues to this day. And so that living culture that is trying to say, think about our values, would be emphasized. And so this advisory group to the management team wouldn't be exclusively tribal. It would include game and fish. It include representatives from the hunting groups and so on. And they are advisory. They would help the agency in going through the new management plan and so on. But the public would still have an input.
That's a really good idea. The regular listeners of Democratic Perspective will recognize some of this language from our discussion of the Sedona proposed national monument. However, the advisory, giving people a chance to at least have some input, and at least monitor the situation as it progresses, as it goes on. And that's the proponents of the National Monument here like to say, well, you know, wait and see. You know, everything isn't going to be, you know, isn't always explained on day one, and certainly some of the folks would like to have it explained on day one, but the Antiquities Act, you know, when you talk to opponents of the national monuments, and we're going to lump Grand Canyon and Sedona together for a moment, when you talk to opponents and you find somebody reasonable you listen to the things that you've just said, you can still shoot your guns. You can still ride your ATVs. You're going to be restricted. You're restricted now where you can shoot your gun. You're restricted now where you can ride your ATV.
Correct.
So a lot of those restrictions don't change. So they begrudgingly, you know, quiet down a little bit. And then they come to the Antiquities Act. Mm-hmm. And that becomes the big unknown.
Yeah, the Antiquities Act is amazingly short act. I did a word count on it. It's about 430 words.
Okay.
In those few words, it states a purpose. It gives the president this authority, and it says any proclamation has to name the objects of scientific and historic interest of why this thing is being designated, and that becomes the purpose of the proclamation. So that tells the agency and the public that this place is special. Hmm. For these specific reasons, and that it doesn't change any of the other rules. It just says maybe when it comes to access, say, to an archaeological site instead of
a land highway
or just off-road vehicle access, it restricts access, puts a parking lot and a trail that's maintained and prohibits off-road vehicles from driving over that arc. So that may be changed, but that is not changed in the proclamation.
Right.
That's changed in the management. And that's not arbitrary and capricious. It's a very public process. People put input to the agency. They challenge the decision of the agency, but it's not a federal fiat. It's not a presidential taking of anything.
That's huge. Again, you know, and that's why I brought it up. They felt like that we were holding back this Antiquities Act as our secret weapon.
My perspective is the mining companies are taking public land out of use. They're conflicting with my recreational use of the lands around the Grand Canyon. They're actually conflicting with hunting. Put roads, you put an industrial complex, you put power lines and trucks going back and forth. That wreaks havoc on wildlife habitat and good hunting.
Absolutely.
And so when we were campaigning to get the 20-year moratorium, we had the hunting industry. We had Arizona Game and Fish on board with it. They signed in support of the withdrawal.
What a change.
And that's all changed dramatically.
Yeah.
And again, it's structured around sound bites that aren't true.
Right.
Arizona Game and Fish is now opposing the monument.
That's right? Correct. And before, they were fully on board with it. The governor of Arizona, Governor Napolitano, was on board with it. And, you know, so were the town of Tucson. Business owners are they say, come on, you know, 30 employees for 5 years, and we've got new dirt roads, new areas opened up, and if one of those trucks overturns on Highway 64, the south entrance to the Grand Canyon, it shuts down access to the Grand Canyon for 24 hours, what's that going to do to our pocketbook? I mean, it's just too big of an economic risk. I mean, you can say, okay, we can manage the pollution and the radioactivity, but still, there's this, it's like putting an industrial zone in a cathedral.
That's something I think everyone needs to really be concerned about is the Grand Canyon is one of the great economic drivers of the state of Arizona for tourism. It's the major tourist attraction in the state and one of the biggest in the country. And we're putting this into a, since this is a political show, putting this into to a political context, I think we need to tell people what they can do to help this. And I think if you care about the history of the canyon and the culture of of the region, the culture of Native Americans, if you care about the environment and you care about the economic aspect of tourism, generated by the Grand Canyon, you need to contact your congressional representative, in this case, Ann Kirkpatrick.
Yes.
And we should also, although I think we'll be wasting our time doing it, but I think we should also contact Trent Franks and others in the state.
Grijalva's
already on board, but Gosar, I think,
he will do everything he can to try to sabotage.
Right.
Well, Gosar has introduced legislation to prevent Obama from using the Antiquities Act to do just this.
But still, he'll have to listen to people if he gets enough resistance. Yeah. I think we all need to contact our representatives and tell them to get behind this.
It does matter. It really, really, really does.
Yeah, and Kirkpatrick has to get on board with this for the president to take this bold political move. That it's not sufficient just to have Ann. And the calculus that they're doing, I cannot explain either Ann or even the Obama administration. Our strategy and our thinking about it is that if you look at the national interests, Arizona's interests, poll after poll show that the Grand Canyon is a place that all of us support. And John McCain has been a staunch supporter in the past of protecting the Grand Canyon from air tours, from a number of assaults. And this is a reasonable withdrawal. It doesn't affect the world supply of uranium. The company that is mining it is shipping most of it to South Korea on a long-term contract. This is just a place where once it's mined out, it's going to leave another deadly legacy of contaminated soil, contaminated water, like we have seen time and time again around the Four Corners.
We had the big mine burst in
near
Durango. I've hiked in that country, backpacked in that country. There are mines that are leaking small amounts of water everywhere.
The irony is, the Republicans have launched a campaign against the Environmental Protection Agency for being irresponsible. Well, hello, that was a privately developed mine that was abandoned and put on the taxpayer's shoulders, and the EPA is doing its darndest, despite Republican efforts to defund it, to do a good job, and they made a mistake.
Why do we have to clean it up? Why does our agency, the EPA,
The law does not allow a pathway to the responsible party, because it was 100 years ago.
Imagine if the spill into the Animas River from the Gold King mine had been from a uranium mine.
Well, I got one.
Was radioactive.
Yeah.
Imagine the consequences of that.
Yeah. What was that? About 3,000 gallons, they figured? I mean, I know it's still leaking. You could see it.
That was massive. There, in that area, if you're walking along the Animas, there's a whole bunch of small mines here, and I've been there and seen them leaking. If you go through into the Chicago Basin, or if you go to the west along on the river, they're small. They're small mines, or they're just they're not. What was it? There's no iron. When I was there, there was no iron grates or anything.
Right.
There's just polluted water draining from it, small amounts from a lot of different places.
Well, let me give you an example and compare it to the Animas and the Gold King spill. In 2009, the Pine Nut uranium mine was reopened after it was shut for over 20 years. And when they opened it up, it was filled with water. The shaft, all that side shafts into the ore where they'd been mining ore was flooded in water. And all that water was highly contaminated because it was in direct contact with the uranium ore. They had to pump it all out before they could start to open the mine again. It was over 2,000 gallons. You couldn't see it. It looked like normal water, but it was highly radioactive, and it sat in that shaft, potentially percolating down into the groundwater below it for we don't know how long. So there is a slow motion spill that is occurring out of sight, out of mind, and that's the pernicious problem with uranium mining. Is you can make the surface look okay, and you can sort of say we'll seal the shaft. But geology is full of cracks.
Yep.
And somehow that mine filled with water. When they walked away from it, it was required. They had to cap it with concrete. So it wasn't like, they were negligent. They did what was logical, but somehow water got into it. The geologists think it probably was, major downpour events that came in through the cracks, maybe some seepage from perched aquifers, but it was wet.
I don't think I'm going to overstate this, that I don't think there's a single type of mining operation on the planet that doesn't result in severe pollution.
Risk-benefit ratio.
If you see it with the mountaintop removal in West Virginia for coal, huge ecological consequences. You see it with copper and gold and mines and silver mines and in the West. Almost always it ends up putting lead and arsenic into the water, the groundwater. Uranium mines put radioactive waste into the water. It's this is something that needs to be very carefully reviewed before mines are ever allowed to take place, particularly in sensitive areas like the Grand Canyon.
I think what's been happening in the past, folks, are people are able to put in all these mines all over Colorado and down in here, put in these mines, extract, make a bunch of money, and just leave them. Newer mines, they have sort of minimal restrictions, and they leave for the American people to clean up the mess. They externalize their cost. In other words, what I think Gary is saying is, if you should look at the mine as a holistic thing. You start the mine and you extract the minerals, you make your money, but then you have to restore the situation. And while you're doing it, you have to monitor your impact on the area around it. And I think that. Obviously, if you can escape the cost of doing that, and if you're in business, you'll do it.
Right.
So it has to be required by the governments of the world to monitor these things. Otherwise, you have horrible situations. So I just don't think when they're motivated to make profit, they're going to do it voluntarily.
And one of the issues is quite simply a lack of funding for regulators. Mm-hmm. There aren't enough people to monitor mines. Mm-hmm. And so the companies, when they're not closely monitored, tend to cut corners, because it makes more money for them.
Well, stated differently, and I agree with you, is when the 1872 mining law was enacted, that gave a right for private companies to enter public lands. The challenge is that it put the burden of proof on the public and on the agencies to prove that these uses were causing a problem. Otherwise, it was assumed that they could be done and with minimal impact. And over time, what we've learned, particularly with uranium mining, is that's not true.
Tell folks where they can find out about the Grand Canyon Trust, where they can find out about the proposal. There's beautiful photographs of the area. This is a beautiful area that needs preservation. Tell the folks where they can find this on the internet.
You can find it in several places. Our website, GrandCanyonTrust.org, is one place. Greater Grand Canyon Wildlands Council.org, and sierraclub.org all have materials up on this.
Your representatives will be in town over the holidays. Anchor Patrick will be here. You are listening to Democratic Perspective. Our podcasts are on vbid.org. Catch this show and all our shows on vbid.org.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.